Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Stephanie Ruffi, who is Professor of Philosophy and Head of the Philosophy, Practices, and Languages Research Laboratory at Université Grenoble-Alpes. Her new book, Scientific Pluralism Reconsidered, A New Approach to the Disunity of Science, is just out from University of Pittsburgh Press. The idea that the sciences can't be unified, that there will never be a single theory of everything, is by now a bit of an orthodoxy in philosophy of science, and in many sciences as well. But different versions of pluralism present different views of what exactly they are pluralistic about in science, and about why sciences cannot be unified, and what the failure of unification entails about the world and about our knowledge of the world. In her book, Ruffi untangles a number of different issues within the pluralist camp, arguing for a foliated pluralism in ontology and the interest relativity of knowledge claims and our representations of the world to historical features and our epistemic interests. She also critically examines anti-reductionist arguments and both the generality of their conclusions and the support they may seem to provide for inferences to the disorder of the world. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Stephanie Ruffi, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy. I'm very happy to be talking to you about your new book, Scientific Pluralism Reconsidered. And I'd like to start out with a few words about your own background in terms of how you came to become a philosopher and how you got into the areas you did and how you came to write this particular book.
Okay. So actually, my background was initially in science and technology. And so I first graduated as an engineer, and then I got a first PhD in astrophysics in Paris. I worked on the structure and evolution of the galaxy. But at the same time, I was very interested in philosophy. And so I started studying philosophy in addition to my scientific studies. And so I studied philosophy for 5 years. But it was at that time mainly history of philosophy, because in France, that's what you get mainly in the university. Mm-hmm. So after 5 years, I was finishing my PhD in astrophysics, so I had to make up my mind and choose, because I couldn't do both anymore at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I had to make a choice, you know, astrophysics or philosophy. And I took a break. I worked in the private sector for a while, and then I decided to go on with philosophy, and I applied to a PhD program in the States. And I was lucky to be accepted at Columbia, so I moved to the States, and I got a second PhD in philosophy at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And quite naturally, given my background in science, I specialized in philosophy of science at that time. And when I arrived at Columbia, I was supposed to do philosophy of physics. But then Philip Kitcher arrived at Columbia at that time, and I got interested in other branches of philosophy of science. And I was attracted more by, broader question about the sciences rather than, specializing in philosophy or physics. And so I started working in general philosophy of science during my PhD. And because I was interested in general question about science, I got interested in the question of the articulation between different branches of science. And this is, at that moment, I started to write, papers about well-known philosophers like Cartwright or Dupré, who wrote about the plurality of science and the relationship between the various branches of science. And that's how I started writing on these topics. And I was especially interested in basic issues like, what can you learn about the world from science once you reject a unified view of science? And so I started writing papers on specific dimension of this broad question. And then I thought, maybe I should try to articulate these various specific takes on the issue and write a book about the question of unity, of disunity of science in general,
right,
just not specific aspects. So that's how I came to write this book.
Good. It's a very topical question because, it's, as you put it, the disunity of science. I mean, philosophy of science, of course, as you very nicely begin the book by looking at Carnap and the logical positivists, or Carnap in particular. And, of course, people coming from philosophy of science, that's kind of the, we all get that before we start to reject all the pieces of it. And as you mentioned, I mean, Nancy Cartwright and John Dupré, I mean, these were, important among the important figures in terms of rejecting that whole view and promoting disunity, the disunity view. And at this point, the idea of pluralism or disunity is kind of an orthodoxy. I mean, that's sort of where it is. But there's a lot of kind of open questions that you consider here about different what exactly we can. Why it is that, what it is that isn't disunified, why it is, and what those implications are. So I think it's nice to have in a fairly tidy package, a sort of consideration of, what is this, scientific pluralism, what are the best views within it, what are the best defenses of those views. So, I want to get each of the various pluralisms that you discuss in the book. I also noticed that this is in English now. So it's been translated from the French, but it's also been revised and augmented from the French. And
yes.
So I was just wondering if you could say a bit about, what the areas of the book were that you felt, in the translation process, where you kind of, worked further, in the presentation of your view in the English edition.
Yes. So the major revision was concerned the introduction and the conclusion. It was completely rewritten because the tradition, the style when you're in French, when you write a book, is not to write a long introduction which will spell out the content of the book. So I had to really think about the introduction and conclusion with a new, a fresh look at it. And I benefited from nice reviews from anonymous reviewers from my publisher. And that was very helpful to help better articulate the three main parts of the book. So this is another, I think, improvement on the French version. The three parts are better articulated and put together. I think it's more coherent in the English version. I added some transition and articulation, which was not which was very implicit in the French version. Mm-hmm. So to that extent, the book was augmented by those transitions and articulations. And I hope the English version is more like coherent. The three parts are more coherent.
Yeah, well, I mean, it certainly is coherent. I mean, more coherent, I can't assess since I haven't read the French one. But so you do, you know, it's divided into three main areas of controversy. One is the what you call the languages, objects, and methods, and you know, sort of the main question there is, you know, are there different kinds of things that can only be known in different sorts of ways? You know, sort of discussing, you know, starting again from Carnap, you discuss it, and ultimately, of course, you come out with your own view of, you know, answer is no, and you give your own view. So maybe you could explain a bit the Carnapian, you know, to start where you start, the Carnapian form of pluralism, you know, that you articulate kind of clearly, and then where, you know, contemporary pluralists have rejected that view.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, because it could be a bit surprising to go back to the Vienna Circle in a book which is mainly about current forms of scientific pluralism. But so my purpose was certainly not to contribute to the very rich scholarship in the history of philosophy of science that focuses on the Vienna Circle. But I was motivated by the fact, by the motivation for the defense of the unity of science by the logical positivist, and which is very well known, which is that the idea that unity of science, defending the unity of science is the way of defending cooperation between scientists. So I like this motivation a lot. But apart from that, I thought also it was very interesting to recall the answer of Carnap to the question you mentioned, the different ways of knowing different objects, you know. And what was interesting for me is that Carnap defended the unity of the object domain of science at the same time and with appealing to some kind of pluralism, which was his linguistic pluralism. And this linguistic pluralism was goes hand in hand with his principle of tolerance, which is very well known, and which states that, you know, in logic, everyone is at liberty to build up his own logic and his own form of language. So what was interesting in Carnap is that adopting a linguistic framework to reconstruct all scientific sentences, which was the project of Carnap, it's a free choice, which is guided only by pragmatic consideration. And given this principle of tolerance, so the project of reconstructing scientific sentences works together with a plurality of possible unification, because you can choose different linguistic framework to do that. Mm-hmm. And so this, and so also we should, I should specify that this kind of linguistic pluralism, this Carnap's linguistic pluralism, is exclusive and synchronic to the extent that you cannot work in more than one linguistic framework. So it's a bit like a Kuhn's paradigm, you know, and it's also synchronic to the extent that you can not work with, as I said, many linguistic framework at the same time. So now the question is, how is this pluralism compatible with Carnap's ambition to establish ontological unity, which seems to be a bit in tension at first sight? Mm-hmm. And that's why it's really getting interesting, I think, because the idea, Carnap's idea is that Carnap's idea is that what matters in this unity program, what matters is to be able to reconstruct all scientific sentences within a unique framework. And if you succeed doing that, then all differences in terms of epistemic access will be eliminated, so that the object studied by the sciences will belong to the same domain. But they will belong to the same domain, not in the traditional ontological sense of the existence of, you know, only one sort of thing, like only material things or only ideas or things like that. But it will to the extent that everything that can be said about these objects can be said in the same language, within the same linguistic framework, and consequently it will lend itself to the same type of empirical justification. And that's how you get this unity of the object domain of science within a pluralistic framework, which is the plurality of linguistic framework. And I found this association of ontological unity in a special Carnapian sense and plurality very interesting in Carnap's work.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't really thought of his linguistic questions, the external internal questions, you know, as itself a form of pluralism, but it does sort of make sense. But then, of course, I mean, nowadays, you know, there is what you call the double divorce. I mean, this idea that the very sharp distinction between what philosophers of science are doing, and then what the sciences are doing, the practices of science. I mean, that, you know, kind of just started to fall apart with Kuhn, but, you know, I'm sure there were other influences as well, that complete separation has totally been destroyed since then. And also you mentioned of course, the logical positivists had this distinction between the context of discovery and then the context of justification, and their empiricist justifications for that distinction. So can you say a bit about, you know, in that breakdown of the logical positivist orthodoxy into the current view, how did pluralism, you know, come into the picture, I guess is the question.
Yeah, because you mentioned this divorce between a separation between two conception, two views of the notion of unity of method. Because you have first a logical version of the notion of unity of method, which is the idea that there exists only one logic of justification. And you have another version of the idea of unity of method, which is the idea that there is only one best way of finding out about the world, which means there is only one method, one way to elaborate and project scientific results, for instance, by induction or by abduction or whatever. And the fact is that recently, all philosophers of science, or at least philosophers of science has been mainly concerned with the logical version of the unity of method. This is the case since Mill, and it's even more the case for Popper and the logical positivist. But if you think about what happened before, the analysis of processes of discovery in science was not entirely separated from the analysis of processes of validation. So the two sides of the notion of method work together. But after Popper and the logical positivist, the focus was exclusively on logic of justification. Mm-hmm. And that's why I found the notion of style of scientific reasoning, Hacking's notion of style of scientific reasoning, very rich and potentially very interesting, because the very notion of style mixes the two dimensions, logic of justification and ways of finding out about the world. So it's a way to reconcile the two dimensions of the notion of methods and to think about unity methodological unity without separating the two dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, towards the end of that chapter, you kind of turn to Hacking, you know, Ian Hacking's views, where you have different styles of scientific reasoning, which and you build on that view to kind of present your own view of the, you know, how we should answer the question about, you know, pluralism of ontologies and so forth. And you call your view a foliated pluralism. So maybe you can explain a bit about, you know, this notion of styles of scientific reasoning and then how you develop it in your own view of pluralism.
Yeah, I started working on the Hacking's notion of style of scientific reasoning because I thought it was very interesting. It includes both an ontological dimension, because Hacking says that style create objects, and maybe I can explain that a little bit
later. I hope so. Yeah.
And also, in the same notion, you find a methodological dimension in the justificatory sense, to the extent, as Hacking says, that styles develop their own standard of validity. So in the very concept of styles of scientific reasoning, you have these two dimensions, ontological and justificatory, methodologically justificatory. So what does that mean for Hacking, that styles create objects? I mean, Hacking just give examples of creation of object by the different styles he analyzes. And he draws on the work of the historian of science, Alistair Crombie. So for instance, if you consider the statistical style, which is very widespread in science today, so the statistical style will introduces, for instance, and I take Hacking's example here, it introduces, for instance, populations characterized by their mean and the deviation. Mm. If you consider another example of style, for instance, the mathematical style of postulation, it introduces abstract objects such as, you know, complex numbers of sets. If you consider another very widespread style, which is the laboratory style, it often introduces unobservable entities such as electrons or atoms. And so what Hacking says is that those kinds of objects are created by a style to the extent that they did not exist before this time came into being. So it's not very easy to understand what he means exactly by that. So in other words, how exactly should we understand that these objects introduced by a style exist? Is there, and the question I asked is there a mode of existence of the same sort of the mode of existence of unproblematic things like, say, a flower or a star?
Right.
And actually, Hacking doesn't really answer this question. And he rather points out, to escape this question, so to speak, he rather points out to the fact that when a style comes into being, it opens a specific ontological debate. And the examples he gives are, I think, very convincing. For instance, he mentioned the fact that when the mathematical style introduces objects like numbers, the question, the ontological question, the ontological new debate is, it's an old debate in philosophy, but do numbers exist outside the mind of mathematicians? So that's an ontological debate. Mm-hmm. Another example is with the laboratory style, you know, when the laboratory style introduces unobservable entities like electrons. So it opens up an ontological debate, which is very well known, which is a realism versus anti-realism debate. So Hacking escapes this question by, you know, just pointing out that when introducing an object, a style opens up a debate. But then I was interested in the following question. Okay, stars introduce objects, but there are many objects in the world which are already the object of scientific inquiries, like forest fires, stars, and all that.
Right.
So my question was, okay, how do you articulate those objects introduced by a star with the objects already studied by the sciences, like a star, forest fire? And that's how I came to the notion of ontological enrichment, and then to my foliated pluralism. So maybe I can say a word about...
Because that's kind of the critical issue right there is, you know, you've got all these... Well, I mean, from a naive point of view, we have all these objects, and they existed even... At least we thought they existed, you know, if you're going to be a realist, well before science began. And now you have scientific styles, but, you know, it seems like there's two classes of objects, those that are introduced by styles and those that are not. And, you know, how are these things related, you know, and why think, I suppose, that the ones that, you know, why think one class seems to be somehow ontologically inferior to the other, or maybe it's not. I mean, that's a question, really. But Hacking's view does seem to make this distinction between, I mean, he does have the, between the objects that are not introduced by styles and objects that are.
Now, actually, Hacking doesn't really address this question of the articulation of these two types of objects. So
yeah.
I try to fill this gap by proposing this notion of ontological enrichment. And so my suggestion is that when a style of scientific reasoning introduces a new kind of entity, like the object introduced by a style, so this entity does not simply add further to the existing scientific objects, mm-hmm. independently of the objects already studied by scientists. So what I mean is that it's not like there are stars, dogs, electrical phenomena to which styles would add the class of variable stars or the species Canis lupus or the electron. So rather what I suggest is that the introduction of new kinds of entities by a style gives rise to an ontological enrichment of the object studied by science, to the extent that the use in scientific practice of different styles of reasoning widen, diversify the classes of propositions that can be true or false about them. And maybe I can give an example to make that more concrete.
Yeah.
So think about, for instance, galaxies, you know, which has been studied by astrophysicists for a while now. So the idea is that when astrophysicists started to use the style of hypothetical modeling, they added various models of galaxies, especially models of the Milky Way. And so by doing that, they're extending the types of propositions that can be formulated about the galaxies. For instance, they added propositions about physical parameters that were not observationally accessible, but using those models made them accessible. So, and also the statistical style has introduced in astrophysics populations of galaxies, mm-hmm. which were characterized by various statistical parameters. So if you think this way, you can define the idea that the coming into being of stars, the use of new stars in a given branch of science, lead to an enrichment of the object under study. And this is my notion of ontological enrichment.
Okay.
Let me just add that.
Sure.
This process is it's important to see that this process of ontological enrichment is an open-ended process, to the extent that a new style of scientific reasoning may emerge in the future, which will bring new entities that will add ontologically to the object under study. So it's an open-ended process, this ontological enrichment process.
Okay. So let me just, I mean, because as you're you know, explaining that, I was thinking, well, I mean, so we started with the Carnapian idea of, you know, many languages, one ontology, kind of. You know, I was just wondering how, you know, if styles are giving ontological enrichment of, in terms of more ways of talking about, you know, so like in the statistical style, you have, you know, populations, whether it's stars or species of various, you know, animals and so forth. But I suppose I'm wondering what is gained by saying these are this is ontological enrichment as opposed to conceptual or linguistic or, you know, another type of enrichment, but not an ontological enrichment. Because, do you see what I'm? Because, you know, Carnap might just say, oh, no, you're just articulating kind of my view in a somewhat different way. He might, you know, somebody defending Carnap might say something like that. And I'm just wondering, where does the ontological enrichment come about?
Yeah, I think it's important to see that the notion of ontological enrichment does not boil down to the notion of descriptive enrichment.
Okay.
Because I think it was what you were pointed at.
Yeah.
Because the use of a new style of scientific reasoning does not simply amount to grasp more aspects of a given object. So, for instance, if you take a model of the climate today, a model of the Earth climate today does incorporate more components that the climate models say in the 70s. But this is not what's going on here, because this will be only descriptive enrichment.
Mm-hmm.
So here we can talk about ontological enrichment, because that means taking seriously this idea, the Hacking's idea, that styles create new objects,
yeah,
and that style adds certain entities to the object. And if you take that seriously, that also means that to some extent you adopt an internalist approach of ontology, because your ontology, and that's where there are some very some similarity with Carnap, but not so many, because your ontological features of an object are not given independently of the cognitive tools you use to know the object. So when you take seriously Hacking's idea that style adds certain entities to the object, you have to buy, to a certain extent, an internalist approach of ontology, because you have to buy the idea that certain ontological features of an object do not exist independently of the style or outside the style.
Okay, so let me just
price to pay, if you can say, a basic realist take on ontology.
Yeah. So one of the features, there's different features or characteristics that you mentioned about foliated pluralism, but just kind of focusing on one of those. One of the things that you mentioned is, and this is directly in contrast with the Carnapian view, so it would help to further clarify the difference, is that you claim that the foliated pluralist view is non-exclusive, as opposed to the exclusivity of his view. So maybe you could say a bit about that characteristic of the view. Yeah.
Yeah, it simply refers to the fact that a scientific inquiry about a given object or phenomenon often combine simultaneously several styles of scientific reasoning. So if you study a forest fire or a galaxy, to take simple examples, you usually use more than one style. You can use the statistical style, the modeling style, the the laboratory style. So that's why you have this non-exclusiveness by contrast with Carnap's linguistic framework, because you combine very often, you combine in a scientific inquiry, you combine different styles.
Okay. Yeah, that seems like a very important feature, particularly for given Carnap's original motivation that you mentioned before about promoting, you know, communication between the sciences, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talking about relationships between the sciences. So in chapter two, you turn to the issue of intertheoretic relations, and in particular the very big issue of reduction or not. There the question is, you know, is basically is reductionism true? I mean, can theories, be reduced to ultimately one, theory of everything, I suppose. But even if you can't have one theory of everything, can you at least have many, so maybe local reductions or something? There's a lot, very interesting conversation there that you have with traditional anti-reductionist views like Kitcher or Fodor, and you argue that these views rely on certain undefended metaphysical positions, and you also question further on the idea that if there isn't reduction, that you get to this sort of disunified, the dappled world of Cartwright or the disorder of things of Dupré. So there's, two different issues that you talk about separately. So we can take them one at a time. One was your critique of the traditional non-reductionists or anti-reductionists, and the second was the critique of, some of the conclusions that are drawn in terms of what the world is like if reduction is false. So maybe you can start with your criticisms of the sort of traditional, maybe Fodor, Kitcher type anti-reductionist views.
Okay. So maybe I should mention first that when you discuss reductionism, you and this is the reason why I was not very happy with the Kitcher's or Fodor's conclusion. Well, when you discuss reductionism, you can adopt a descriptive approach. That is, you can be interested in local inspections of inter-theoretic relations between theories in different branches of science. So you're going to ask whether a given theory is reducible or not to another theory at a given time of the history of the disciplines involved, mm-hmm. in what precise sense of the notion of reduction. If you adopt this kind of descriptive approach, then your analysis remains internal to science to the extent that the conclusions you're going to give about the reducibility or non-reducibility remain dependent on a given epistemic context and on the particular notion of reduction you adopt. But if you consider Fodor's or Kitcher's approach, it's very unlike this descriptive approach to the extent that those anti-reductionist arguments like Fodor's or Kitcher's, they appear by contrast like hanging over science, like external to science, to the extent that their conclusions aim to remain valid independently of the evolution of the epistemic context. Mm. Since, according to Kitcher, microbiology is taken to be non-reducible to molecular biology, mm-hmm. whatever is the stage of development of biology. And so how can these authors have this absolute notion of reducibility or non-reducibility? And if you analyze their arguments at some stage of their arguments, you find claims like this is non-reducible because, And this is Fodor's claim, because the way the world is put together, so a metaphysical claim. And in Kitscher, that's the same. You find in his argument, ultimately, claims like this is not reducible because levels of organization in nature. So if you analyze the arguments, you find out that they ultimately appeal to claims about how the world is, but without giving any justification of these claims. So it's like their conclusion about reductionism depend on certain metaphysical views about the world, mm-hmm. which is not a problem in itself. I mean, that's fine. There's nothing wrong about building a philosophical view on metaphysical intuitions or claims. But the problem is that if you do that, then it's not compatible with prescriptive methodological ambition. Because very often, those anti-reductionist authors, they not only claim that a science is not reducible to another one, but they also criticize actual scientific practice and say, no, you shouldn't adopt, they say to biologists or scientists, you shouldn't adopt a reductionist approach in your scientific practice. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a problem because how are you going to convince scientists that the metaphysical assumptions which are at the core of your anti-reductionist views should be shared also by the scientists? And this is so a limit of the methodological ambition or the prescriptive ambition of anti-reductionist positions. Mm-hmm. You have to choose. If you want to appeal to metaphysical claims, then that doesn't mix well with the taste for prescriptive, being prescriptive, you know, towards scientists.
Right. Yeah. So, and then the other interesting point that you make in that at this point in the chapter is. That you think that, you know, people like Dupre and maybe Cartwright also go a bit too far in terms of what they conclude. So, you know, if whatever your reason might be that reduction fails, even in some more limited sense, as you put it, temporally qualified, right? You know, to a scientific, you know, a theory at a time. You can't conclude from that there's this sort of just disorder in the universe or in the world. Could you say something about that argument? And
yes,
because I thought that was also a nice contribution as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what you said. I criticize this inference, which consists like starting from okay. You can, in certain domain of science, you can see that reductionism fails. And from that, you conclude that the world is disordered. And this is exactly the inference made by Dupre when he concluded to the failure of reductionism, to the disorder of things. This is the title of his book. And it's a very similar inference made by Cartwright. So, but the problem is... Well, you have to go back to the very notion of nomological disorder. What does that mean to have nomological disorder? If you follow Cartwright, that means that the behavior of some bits of the world cannot be accounted, cannot be subsumed under a law, whatever the law you are available at that time. Mm-hmm. And what I might not be able to enter into details, but what I show by a little thought experiment is that the fact that you can subsume a certain phenomenon under a law or not will depend on the kind of questions you asked about the system. And For instance, I take the example of the, this is Cartwright example of a dollar bill in a square, you know, when there is wind. Mm-hmm. And the question is that an ordered or a disordered system? And Cartwright answers, this is a disordered system because you cannot account for the behavior of a dollar bill swept away by the wind in a square, whatever are the dynamical laws which are available. But I show by a little thought experiment that that depends on the question you ask about the system. And if you ask, if you're not interested in precise, if you're not in, it depends on the precision of the results you want. And if you, and so it depends on the question you ask. So that there's no, it's not meaningful to draw from the failure of reduction some conclusions about the order of the disorder of the world, because those conclusions about the order of the disorder of the world remain dependent on the kind of question you ask about the system. And so that was mainly my critique of this kind of inference from failure of reductionism to metaphysical contentions about the order or lack of order of the world.
Okay, good. That was, that sort of leads to my next question, or the next, which kind of goes into the next chapter as well, is this idea of the, what you call, I think, the double dependence or on the history or historical, theoretical state of a science at a time, and then the epistemic interests, you know, what questions we're asking. So could you, before I get to more specific questions that, you know, in this and the next chapter, could you say a bit about this dependence of ontology, you know, on our interests? I mean, just to put it in a very blank, you know, sort of bald type of way.
Yeah. So the general framework is the idea that ontology supervenes on science. And we start with this very, I think today consensual, naturalized take on ontology. And so if you start with the idea that ontology supervenes on science, then when you ask the question, what bits of experience resist or not being subsumed, being accounted for by a theory, can be shown to be dependent on the question asked. That was my previous point, which I couldn't really say in more details, but that's the same argument. And so if you can show, that's what I do in this chapter, you can show that the bits of experience you can subsume in the theory will depend on the question asked. And the consequence of that is that the frontiers of the chunk of reality, the chunk of real things that are the way the theory says they are, become somewhat fuzzy and shifting. So depending on which theoretical framework you use, and in addition to that, depending on the kind of question you're going to ask within a given theoretical framework, you will have a double dependency of the answer to the question, what kind of bits of the world I can subsume under the models of my theory. Mm-hmm. And that leads to this double relativity ontological landscape, relativity to the theoretical framework you use, but also relativity within a theoretical framework to the kind of question. But mm-hmm. this might not be a problem. I mean, people who adopt a naturalized take on ontology, they happily accept that the ontological image depends on the theoretical framework used. And of course, the theoretical framework will evolve with the history of science. Right. So you have the historicity of the ontological image, which is fine. You don't have the same description in Newtonian mechanics that you have now in Einstein's mechanics. And usually that's fine with everybody. But my point is that in addition to this historicity of the ontological image, you have to add a relativity to the questions being asked within a framework. And that is a consequence of my argument I developed in response to Cartwright and all that.
Okay, I think the question that is always rolling around in my head at this point of discussion of these issues is, are there any constraints on these dependence on interests? I mean, from a naive realist point of view, who would just, let's just say somebody who rejects the dependence or something. There's the ontology and sciences discovering what it's like, but it's entirely, I mean, let's just to put it extreme, it's mind independent what the world is like. And once you start introducing the idea of dependence of ontology being dependent on, historicity and our epistemic interests and things like that, then the question is how dependent is it? I mean, what are there any constraints on this? And if so, does that imply some sort of a non-interest relative ontology that's kind of the basis for the rest of it?
Maybe I should add to complete the picture is that we have to keep in mind that when we want to learn something about the ontology of the world from our best theories, mm-hmm. what we can expect from a theory and the models of the theory is it's always, and this is a point, for instance, developed by Paul Taylor, and I really agree with him on that. We should not forget that what you get from successful theories, it's always inexact and idealized ontological descriptions.
Uh-huh.
And this is a key point. This is a key point because if you have in mind that a legitimate epistemic expectation is to get, at best, idealized ontological pictures, which is good enough to do many things, So if you keep in mind this idealized dimension of the ontology you get from scientific theories, then the plurality I defend must be combined with this idealized character to get an ontological landscape which will be pluralist in the sense that it will be a collection of idealized ontological description given by our best theories. But the important point is to see that you can learn a lot about the world by combining these various idealized descriptions. You can learn a lot about, say, water by combining description from atomic physics with description from dynamics. Mm-hmm. In each case, you get idealized ontological description, but you learn a lot about the real system with this perspective, with this specific perspective, ontological perspective.
Okay. Let's turn to the issue of representation, which is what you cover in the last chapter. And this idea that in a sense, you gave a nice example where you have multiple ways of describing this or theorizing about the same phenomenon. And as you put it, pluralists will generally hold that that these representations they're partial, they're contingent, and they don't converge. They're non-convergent. And as you just put it now, you might add that they're also idealized to some. They're always, I guess, idealized to some extent. And this is often presented in terms with using a map metaphor, which you critique in an interesting way. Could you explain this, the pluralism about representations, and then some of the problems with the map metaphor that's used?
Mm-hmm. So the Yeah, because when I yeah, because many forms of many kinds of representation in science today are of another kind than laws and theories. You have computer simulation, explanatory mechanism, taxonomic system. So there are other ways of representing the world. So the fact is, so yes, in this part of my book, I focus on these other forms of scientific representations. And when you consider that, you face very often situations of plurality of this kind of scientific representations. So in this chapter of my book, my question is, what is the epistemic attitude we should have? What is the right epistemic expectation we should have when facing this situation of representational plurality? And that's where the map analogy is helpful, to reconcile this plurality with realist expectation. Because if you think about what it means for a map to represent the object, take, for instance, the example, this is Kitchell's example of the Britannic coast, for instance. Depending on your interest, you will not represent the Britannic coast in the same way if you want to sail, or if you want to walk, or if you want to drive a car and all that. But so nevertheless, so you always have partial representation of a given system. Nevertheless, you can be realist about this partial representation to the extent that in each case you can draw true proposition about your system. If you use a map to drive, you know if your map is accurate if you are successful when you try to drive from one point to another. If you are successful when you drive, then you can infer that you have an accurate representation, for instance, of the direction of indicated on your map. So you can be realist about a certain aspect of the representation delivered by the map. Mm-hmm. But my point, and that's where the critical part comes in, mm-hmm. my point is that it's not so straightforward in the scientific case. What is not straightforward is to be able to infer from your practical success when you use a model, a computer simulation. You can't infer so easily from this practical success the truth of the propositions you can draw from the models or the computer simulations. And this is what I try to show when I discuss, when I have this case study in astrophysics about computer simulation. My point is to show that you can build those computer simulations which will be very empirically successful. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, you have good reason to be not to be too optimistic as regards the ability to represent in a realistic way the real system, in that case, a galaxy or something like that. So my point was to say that, okay, the map analogy is very convincing as regards the compatibility between realism and the existence of a plurality of representation. Mm-hmm. But when it comes in science to certain kinds of models and computer simulations, not all of them, but certain kinds of computer simulation of composite complex system, the analogy is not so successful anymore with map analogy, because you can't be so confident in the realistic virtue of your model, even if the model is empirically successful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I mean, there's a lot of different questions that I'm always kind of curious about the way realism kind of fits into the overall picture there. How exactly does this realism get any purchase within the, at least the pluralist views as you've put them forward?
I think it's really important to not to draw too general conclusion about that. My analysis was really focused on certain kinds of models and computer simulation, but which are more and more common in science today because of capability of computers. It's in many branches of science, people develop very rich and very realistic model of a phenomenon. And the case I analyze in my book is the computer simulation in cosmology. Mm-hmm. So you have this very realistic computer simulation, realistic in the sense that they deliver images that really looks like images you would get from real observations. But the question is, okay, those computer simulations deliver some very realistic, in that sense, description of the phenomenon and the study, but to what extent do you have good reasons to believe that they actually describe how the system is and not only successful in predictions? And so in that kind of computer simulations, my point and my claim is that those kind of scientific inquiries succeeds only in delivering plausible story about a phenomenon, which is very interesting, but that shouldn't be confused with realist expectations about the description of those systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are sort of running out of time. Although you have a very nice, interesting case at the end where you talk about the taxonomy, classification of stars, which of course is your, you know, bringing in your astrophysics background. Because we're sort of running out of time, I just wanted to end with one final question about what you're working on now and what your next project will be.
First, I'm still working on style of scientific reasoning, and more specifically, I'm trying to find out if computer simulations, which are very widespread in science today, do they constitute a new style of scientific reasoning? Uh-huh. That means, do they constitute a new way of finding out about the world in addition to the experimental style, in addition to the theoretical inquiry. So, I think that the answer is yes, that computer simulation does constitute a new style of reasoning in hacking sense, a new way to find out about the world, introduces new objects and new standard of validity and all that. So I'm trying to argue for a positive answer to that question. And I also work in line with my book. I also work on the compatibility between pluralism, scientific pluralism, and a naturalized approach in metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And I tend to conclude that you can't have it both ways. If you take into account development in philosophy of science, such as scientific pluralism, then maybe a naturalized approach in metaphysics is not so promising anymore.
Huh.
And eventually, I also work, and this is clearly the influence of Philip Kitcher, who was my advisor at Columbia. I also work on political dimensions of science. And for instance, I have a collective project on at the interface of political philosophy and science policies, which is about the should we try to democratize the setting of research agenda, and should we try to involve citizens in the choice of big research priorities? So this is something quite different, which I'm working on now.
Very interesting. Well, all three of those projects sound very, very interesting, and I look forward to reading about them. But for the moment, we are out of time. So I just want to thank you once again for taking the time to talk with us at New Books in Philosophy.
Well, thank you very much. It was very nice to talk with you.
Good luck with those projects, and we will look forward to reading about them. You've been listening to my interview with Stephanie Ruffi, professor of philosophy at the Université Grenoble-Alpes in France. We've been talking about her new book, Scientific Pluralism Reconsidered, A New Approach to the Disunity of Science, which is just out from University of Pittsburgh Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you once again for listening.